This is One-on-One with Mark Monty on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever. And Dr. Gary Walton, dentistry with a personal touch.
He's the original Indiana Pacer, the first captain too, and perhaps the most underappreciated player in franchise history. Struggling for recognition from the start of his basketball career, he had to find a junior college to allow him to continue playing after high school. From there, he earned a scholarship to Arizona State, passing up a chance to play for the Texas Western team that became a historic NCAA champion, and then landed a spot with the Cincinnati Royals. Seeing no future for playing time as a backup to Oscar Robertson, he jumped at the chance to join the Pacers when they began play in a new league, the American Basketball Association. He started at point guard on all three championship teams and still ranks as one of the best leaders in franchise history. His career with the franchise reached an unhappy ending, but he looks back on it now with pride. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Freddie Lewis. Well, this week on One-on-One, it is a pleasure to talk with an ex-Pacer and really one of the most notable ex-Pacers in franchise history, Freddie Lewis. We've talked so far in this series with ex-Pacers such as Mel Daniels, Bob Nedelicki, George McGinnis, Billy Keller, Rick Mount, and of course, Slick Leonard. And it's about time we got to the captain, Freddie Lewis, a man who was an original Pacer, the first player ever signed by the Pacers and went on to have a great career, was the starting point guard on all three championship teams. And Freddie, it's great to have you in town, and I want to go back to the beginnings of your basketball career. You were born in Huntington, West Virginia, and then the family moved to McKeesport, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
When you were how old?
I was 5 years old.
5 years old. Mm-hmm. How did you get started in basketball?
Well, in McKeesport, we had a recreation center. And the recreation center was used for skating, dancing, basketball, whatever the season called for. So I have to tell you, my best sports was football and baseball. But, you know, when we went in to play basketball, we got into a few leagues and stuff, you know, as kids. So I was always a little kid. And playing football and baseball, it had a lot of wear and tear on my knees. And playing football, I think I weighed about 145 pounds or something like this. And as a freshman, I was good enough that the varsity coach wanted me to come out and play with the varsity. And my uncle was on the varsity team. And he says, no way. He says, you'll get broken up and you won't be able to play any other sports. So he says, look, just X out football and pick one of the other sports. So I really chose baseball, but then basketball was there for me to play too. So I just went on and carried on playing both of them. But basketball kind of stuck with me. I put a lot more time into basketball than baseball because when I got into the high school, into 11th and 12th grade, the high school baseball team wasn't that good. So I just stuck with basketball from there on out. And then I went from high school to junior college on a basketball scholarship. I had to go all the way out to Eastern Arizona Junior College on a basketball scholarship because nobody wanted me. I was 6 feet tall, 155 pounds, and coming from a little school in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, nobody knew anything about me. So they always told me, you're too small. So I had to find a school that would give me some kind of help as far as the scholarship was concerned. So it was all the way out in Arizona, Thatcher, Arizona.
Did they find you or did you go out and find them?
I went out and found them.
Yeah.
You know, I made some phone calls. My high school coach, you know, after I was done with high school, he didn't have any success in trying to get me in school or anything. So I did this on my own with some help of some of my other friends too. That one of my friends, he was at Arizona State University, and he told me about the junior college. He said, why don't you go to junior college here in Arizona? And then after you finish there, you can come down to Arizona State with me. And that's what I did. I went to junior college, and I was a hit right off in junior college because I stepped up and made junior college All-American my first year. And my second year, we played Mel Daniels and them in the National Junior College Tournament. And I was the third most sought after player in the nation. Mel was the second most sought after player in the nation.
Who was first?
So a guy by the name of Jim Boyce. He went to school with Mel. You know, so we were the top three players in the country at that time.
Okay.
So from there, I went on to Arizona State.
Yeah, Mel went to New Mexico. You went to Arizona State.
He went to New Mexico. I went to Arizona State. But it was a toss-up for me because I had three schools that were really top on my list, which was Texas Western, which the movie was made by, and they had a spot there for me. With
so you
Bobby
could have
Joe
been on
Hill.
That team.
I was penciled in on being on that team with Bobby Joe Hill, Austin Artis, and Harry Flournoy, and all of, and David Latin. Uh-huh. I mean, I had went down there for a visit, and they loved me. Coach Haskins, he says, "Look, this is it." And the other school was Wichita State, where Warren Jabali was.
Yeah.
You know, so he and Dave Stallworth and Nate Bowman and Kelly Pete and all those guys, they were like, they loved me coming out of junior college. They said, look, you can fit right in. We can win a national championship. So I chose Arizona State because my friend from back in Pennsylvania was at Arizona State. So I just chose Arizona State.
You must have a little bit of regret about that. Even though your career worked out fine, you could have been on a national championship team.
I could have been on a national championship team. And I look at the movie now and I says,
you're talking about Glory Road.
You know, I mean, hindsight is something. But, you know, that was a great situation there. And I tell you, Arizona State was one of the best moves I made, though, because I loved the school. I loved the weather and everything out there. And I made some good friends out at Arizona State, too.
Well, after you get out of Arizona State in 1966, you were drafted by the Cincinnati Royals of the NBA. Mm-hmm. What round did they take you in?
Believe it or not, they took me in the last round.
The last round?
They had eight rounds at that time, round number eight. And they took me in the last round, so everybody was penciling me out. Even the coach, he even said, he says, look, we're just taking you as a favor to Ned Wolk. He said, because Ned had an opportunity to go to Cincinnati to be the coach that year, but he turned it down to stay in Arizona. And he asked him, he says, look, if you can just give my kid a look, you know, that would satisfy me. Give him a fair shake, and that would satisfy me. So I went to rookie camp. And in rookie camp, I really did well. So Jack McMahon says, look, we weren't planning on keeping you. We were planning on cutting you right after rookie camp. He says, but we can't cut you. You're not only the best guard in camp, you're the best player. You're the best athlete here that we have. And I tell you who they had in camp that time. They had their number one draft choice from the year before, who was Flynn Robinson.
I remember him, a guard.
Out of Wyoming. The year I was drafted, number eight, they had drafted as number two Jerry Lee Wells out of Oklahoma City as a guard. So these were two guys that were coming, and Flynn didn't go to camp or was on that team the year before. He came, he had a heart murmur or something, so he sat out that whole year. So he came in my rookie year, so all three of us were sitting here as rookies trying to make this Cincinnati Royals basketball team. Plus, they already had Oscar Robertson and Adrian Smith and John McLaughlin. So it's like, uh-oh, you know, you're in deep trouble, Freddie, to make this team. So, and they only carry four guards. But it worked out fine for me. The first time in the history of the NBA that the one team kept five rookies.
Wow. Five
the Cincinnati rookies. Royals, yeah. And we had on that team was myself, a guy by the name of Bob Butterbean Love.
Sure.
Remember Bob Love who played with Chicago Bulls? He was my roommate that year. A guy, their number one draft choice was Walt Wesley out of Kansas. Their number two draft choice was Jim Ware out of Oklahoma City. And let me see, myself, Flynn Robinson, Jim Ware, Bob Love, and Walt Wesley.
Okay.
Those were the five guys.
Okay. Well, your rookie season, you're playing behind Oscar Robertson, that point guard, so there's not a lot of minutes there for you.
Right.
And your stats, you played in 32 of the games. You averaged 4.7 points. You played 10.4 minutes per game. So that's not bad for a rookie, but obviously with Oscar Robertson there's not a great future for opportunity for a backup point guard.
Uh-huh.
But what was it like? I mean, Oscar at this time is really in the prime of his career.
Yes.
What was it like playing with him and behind him?
It was, I tell you, it was fantastic, because this is what happened. Even though I only played in 32, 35 games, whatever it was, Oscar played one-on-one with me every day after practice. He told me, he says, look, he gave me the nickname Little Lou. He says, look, Little Lou, this is what you have to do. He says, it's a big difference from college basketball to professional basketball. He says, you have to use your quickness, you have to use your skills, and you have to use them in a quick manner. And he says, this is the way you play professional basketball. So he showed me, he really taught me that whole year how to play the professional game. And it really helped me, because after that first season, that's when the ABA was formed. And Mike Storn, who was the head ticket guy in Cincinnati, signed me to a contract right after we lost the four straight games to the champions, the Philadelphia 76ers, Wilt Chamberlain and Hal Greer and Luke Jackson and Wally Jones.
One of the greatest teams of all time.
Billy Cunningham. I mean, they had a super team.
Lewis becomes a Pacer, the original Pacer, in fact, and becomes the captain of the three championship teams when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One with Freddie Lewis, I'm Mark Monteith. Lewis was the original Pacer. There's some speculation that he wasn't the first to actually sign a contract, but he was definitely the first to agree to sign with the team. It turned out to be a great break for the Pacers, because Lewis became the starting point guard on all three ABA championship teams and the captain. As you'll hear in this segment, it was more than just a title. Well, the ABA is formed in the spring of 1967, and Mike Storin, who had gone to college and been in the Marines with some of the founders of the Pacers, is hired to be the GM out of Cincinnati, of this new league, and the first thing he does is sign Freddie Lewis to a contract.
That's right. As a matter of fact, he didn't even let me get out of town after we had lost the four straight games to Philadelphia in the playoffs. Mike called me to his house. And I went over and visited with him and Hannah. And he says, look, he says, I'm getting ready to go to Indianapolis to be general manager of this new team in the ABA called the Indiana Pacers. He says, and I'd like for you to go with me. He says, and as an incentive for you to go with me, he says, I'll make you the captain of the team. I'll sign you to a 3-year no-cut contract. And we'll just go from there. I says, Mike, let's go.
So you had no hesitation?
No hesitation.
Even though it's a new league that may not make it?
Even though it was a new league, I thought it was a great opportunity for me, because I felt like even though it was a new league and I came to this league, if you remember, and, you know, I mean, this isn't one thing that I'm really proud of, but I had, you know, when I came here, I was the leading scorer on the team that first season. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make a statement that I was good enough to play anywhere. So if an NBA team wanted me back and I had to jump back, if this league didn't work, then I would do that. But I wanted to make a statement, so that's what I did. And I really, you know, came here and I thought I did well. Okay. I stayed.
So you made a point of being the leading scorer?
Well, I made a point of being one of the top players in the league.
Okay.
That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And in order to be one of the top players, in order for somebody to see you, you had to score points. You know,
absolutely.
I mean, they weren't going to look at somebody here, you know, just making assists and stuff like that. They wanted to see somebody that was scoring.
Yeah. Well, you were the captain. Yeah. And from everything I've heard, you seem to be a natural leader, because a couple stories that I just recall off the top of my head about your leadership. Jimmy Rail told me once that the first year of the franchise, he was on the bus waiting to go to the arena or where airport, whatever, and you brought him a cup of coffee just as a little favor. You know, mm-hmm. Jimmy, I know you like coffee. Yeah. He that stuck in his mind. Mel tells me the story of the game where he complained to you about not getting the ball, and you got mad, and you started cussing him. You said, my wife's on my butt, and my kids are running around the neighborhood causing trouble. My dog's biting people. Everybody's on my behind. And you want the ball? If you want the ball, go get a rebound. And that's like a coach will just salivate to get a point guard like that. I mean, you're telling the guy, if you want the ball, go get a rebound. So, I mean, where does that all come from, that the coach on the floor type of thing?
Well, I don't know. I guess from my early years in playing in sports, I always just wanted to be the leader. You know, I wanted to be the guy that they could count on, you know, coming down the stretch. I always wanted to take the last shot. I always wanted to take the big shot. I always wanted to take the blame for whatever. And Mel and them will all tell you, if there was a mistake made on the floor, I might not even be in the picture, but I'd come to them and tell them it was my fault because I wasn't there for them. And they really appreciated this. You know, they really appreciated me stepping up and taking all of this criticism or whatever it might be. You know, hey, it wasn't your fault. It was my fault because I wasn't there for you. And I let them know that that's the way I felt. And anytime they needed me, that they could call on me and I would have their back.
Mm-hmm.
And they really appreciated that.
Is that something you learn or something that's instinctive?
I think it's something that's instinctive because, you know, I'll tell you, I was traded from the Pacers to Memphis and from Memphis to St. Louis. When I was traded to Memphis, I went down there. They automatically voted me captain of the team. When I was traded from Memphis to St. Louis, to the Spirits of St. Louis, when they picked me up at the airport, was taking me to practice, he said, by the way, you're already elected the team captain. I said, I haven't even met these guys yet. I don't even know the guys on the
team. But the players had already decided.
But the players had decided that I was coming in. He's the guy. So, you know, I was captain of every team that I was on.
Yeah.
Only out of my 12 years of playing, only team that I wasn't captain of, my rookie year with Oscar.
That's understandable.
That's understandable, yeah.
Well, let's go back to that first year again. The first game, first Pacer game ever against the Kentucky Colonels is sold out of the Coliseum. Mm-hmm. Now, Storn gave away a few thousand tickets because he was smart enough to make sure we were going
exactly right.
to start off with a bang here. But mm-hmm. one thing that has always struck me as funny, you guys had a parade at Eagledale Shopping Center the day before that first uh-huh. game. Do you even remember that?
I vaguely remember that. Yeah, Eagledale Shopping Center.
I think it rained, uh-huh. and you guys are out there trying to drum up some attention.
Some people to come.
As a player, were you surprised by the turnout for that first game? Were you kind of shocked when you show up for this game and suddenly there's 10,000 people there?
Well, I was shocked, but I was happy. And I said, well, look, this is what has to happen. We have to start winning.
You also played in the very first ABA All-Star game out of Butler Fieldhouse uh-huh. that year, a nationally televised game that the Pacers yes. sponsored.
Exactly.
Again, Storn gave away a lot of tickets and mm-hmm. got a crowd out there.
That was a great turnout out there.
Yeah.
Great game. I can tell you who won the most valuable player in that. Larry Brown won
yes.
the most valuable player in that. And myself and Connie Hawkins and Roger was there. And, I mean, we had the
Neto,
a great group
it?
Of people. Yeah, Neto was there. We, as a matter of fact, we had three of the Pacers, me, Roger, and Neto.
Yeah. All three of us. And Mel was a rookie in Minneapolis, and yeah. he played in it and mm-hmm. should have gotten MVP, but they took the voting too early.
Yes.
And Larry Brown got it.
And Larry got it. Yeah, that's
right. And Mel says he walked in the locker room afterward and apologized. I said, Mel, I'm sorry. You should have won this.
Yeah.
And Larry won a car, but he sold it and kept the money, which was smart.
Yeah. Well, that's what I did. With the horse.
Yes, I'm going to ask you about that because okay. you're the MVP of the All-Star game coming up here. But let's talk about the championships. You mentioned 1970 when Roger just went nuts and averaged more than 40 points a game and you mm-hmm. beat the L.A. Stars.
Yeah.
One thing that's interesting, you won all three of your ABA titles on the road. You guys
that's
couldn't
right.
close them out at home. Yeah.
Well, you have to think, they were six games. We won every one of them in six games.
That's
if
right.
If we would have come home for a seventh game, we
– Yeah.
You know what? I'm not going to say that because we lost our only seventh game series at home against the Utah Stars in 1971.
That's right.
All the rest of them, we won on the road. We didn't want to take any chances going to seventh game.
But in two of your three championship years, you could have won them at home in five games and weren't able to do it. So there's something about that pressure, the expectation of winning it at home. When all the fans are there and the champagne's on ice and everybody's expecting it, that puts a certain amount of pressure on you, I think.
Yes.
People always talk about you got to have home court advantage in the playoffs, and I think, I don't know, it seems like, at least for the Pacers, it's almost easier to win on the road when you're not expected to win.
That's right, yeah. And we're more relaxed on the road anyway because our fans are expecting us to do this. And, they put a lot more pressure on our guys, by the way that they're responding to the things that we're doing. But on the road, they're a lot more relaxed.
Yeah,
And we took that as a motivational thing. Their fans, the way they got behind their fans on the road, we just rubbed their face.
It was fun, wasn't it? To go out there. I know Slick used to tell you guys, go out there like you own the damn place.
That's right, exactly right.
And he just had that mentality that hey, we're in charge here. Mm-hmm. You had really one of the great moments of your career in the 72. Finals against the Nets. Rick Barry's playing for the Nets. Yes. You scored 33 points in the first game, which the Pacers won. In game five, you had a steal and hit the game-winning free throws with 9 seconds left for a one-point win, and that gave the Pacers a 3-2 lead in the series. Then you went out to New York and wrapped up the series, and you were the MVP of the finals.
Yes, that was a great highlight of my career there, winning that most valuable player in that playoff in 72. Because if anybody remembers back in 71 when we lost the championship, which I thought we should have won in 71, I was, put on the bench. I was not a starter at that time anymore. And, I was coming off the bench and we were just really struggling. And the seventh game at the Coliseum, we were playing Utah and we were down like 16 going into the second quarter. Slick put me in the game, and then we closed the deficit to 5 at halftime. And I'm all hyped up, ready to go back in the second half. And, again, I was put on the bench, and we lost the game. We got too far down in the third quarter that we couldn't survive, come back.
Yeah.
And after that game, I really took it to heart. I cried. I did not change my uniform after the game. I stayed in my warm-ups and stuff. And I went out to a park. I went out to Washington Park, and I sat up underneath a tree by myself and just got all of this out of me. And I said to myself, this is never going to happen again. And the next year, things happened. A guy was traded. I moved back into the starting lineup, and that's when I went on to win the most valuable player.
So that's interesting. In 71, when you go to Washington Park after the game, were you disappointed in yourself, or are you mad at Slick for not playing anymore? Or
well, it was probably just a disappointment, of our team not being able to close out a series, a seven-game series at home. And I felt like I told you before, I always feel like I'm the one, Don't blame it on anyone else. I blame myself. So for not being able to do whatever it might have been for us to come up with this victory. So, I dedicated myself to work more, work harder, throughout the summer, because all of my off summers I spent with younger guys here around the city, in Dust Bowls, summer leagues and whatever. I worked out with them, worked out real hard, just like a regular training camp. And when our training camp started, then I was, ready to play right at the beginning of training camp. I didn't have to get in shape or anything. So Slick always appreciated me coming into camp ready to go. And on the other hand, too, there was other guys in there to try to take my job. So I had to be ready to go. I'm a 6-foot guy. You're expendable. There's a million 6-foot people. It's a difference if you're 7 foot or 6'10 and a great talent or whatever. But when you're 6 foot, they're all over the country.
Yeah.
So you got to be on your top game in order to keep your job. So that's what I wanted to do.
The core of the Pacer championship teams breaks up, but Lewis finds success elsewhere and receives a most unusual reward when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One on One. I'm Mark Monteith. Today's guest is former Pacer Freddie Lewis, who, unlike Roger Brown and Mel Daniels, found success with another team after leaving the Pacers. Lewis was even named MVP of the ABA All-Star Game one year in San Antonio. And as you'll hear in this segment, that was an honor that brought a most unusual reward. 173, the Pacers come back and win the championship again, this time over Kentucky. The season had not gone as well. Things are kind of coming apart a little bit. But the Pacers rally against the Colonels in the finals of the ABA. You win in it. Win game seven down in Louisville. You had scored 31 points in game four, and you were the starter again. And that's the last championship, kind of the last hurrah, really, for this great team. What do you recall from that season? And it's just interesting to me how it's always hard to keep a great basketball team together for very long because guys start getting frustrated with roles, and it's, you know, success is always an obstacle. When you've won championships, you know, guys get a little looser. Work ethic may not be the same. Things start coming up. You guys kept it together for about 5 years there where you were on top. But it just does start to come apart there. That 73 championship, the last hurrah of the Pacers there, what do you remember from that?
I remember us being down 3-1 in, I think, two of those series. And, you know, our coach and general manager came in and said, look, you know, you guys are way better than this. You know, let's pull ourselves together and come on up and win these things, because we had won these championships before. If you look back in the years, we were in the finals five straight years, and we won three out of the five, of which I think we should have won four out of the five. And, you know, with a little luck, we could have won all five. But in that particular series, we came back from down 3-1 in two of the series, and we won them. In that last game down in Kentucky, you know, I remember I was on a roll. I mean, I was going really well, and I sprained my ankle in the third quarter. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, this is going to hurt. I went into the locker room, and we were, I think we were up about 8, 9, 10 points. And they started, you could hear the crowd roaring. And whenever a hometown crowd roars, that means the hometown is doing something. So they had a monitor in the locker room. And I looked up at the monitor, and I'll tell you something. A spark went off in George McGinnis's head. George went wild on those guys, and he pulled it out for us. You know, and he was voted most valuable player in that series.
I think he scored like 27 in that game.
You know, and it was like a spark that went off, because I had gone down with a sprained ankle, and it was just odd the way that happened. I came down on Artis Gilmore's foot, twisted my ankle, and instead of him trying to block my shot going up with me, he ducked underneath me, and I'm like, you're 7 foot, I'm 6 foot, how you duck underneath me? So but anyway, that's what happened, and I'll never forget that. George just, you know, had a super game and pulled it out for us.
Well, in 74, the team still stays together and comes back to try to win a fourth title in the regular season, has the ups and downs. You try to rally in the playoffs and don't quite make it. And then that summer, Slick breaks up the team, basically, in 74. You, Roger, and Mel are traded to Memphis, where Mike Storn is the general manager.
Exactly.
And Mel tells me that he actually could have vetoed it. That was in his contract, but he wanted to be with you guys. If they were going to break up the team, he wanted to go too.
Yeah.
It must have been quite a culture shock to go from the Pacers, where you've won three ABA titles, to Memphis, where people really don't care that much.
That's right. And that's what happened. We went down there, and it was like, oh, wow, it's an altogether new atmosphere, altogether new fans. And the fan base wasn't what we was used to, and it was really tough. See, that was a year after the first game. I think I played two games or so in Memphis, and I was traded from Memphis to St. Louis. And the reason I was traded from Memphis to St. Louis, you wouldn't know this story, Mark, but the owners of the St. Louis team, we went into St. Louis to open their season in the Checkerdome and everything. They had us down, I think, 6 or 7 points going into the last 2 minutes or something on the game, and then I scored 10 straight points. They asked Memphis for me. They wanted to trade for me. They sent Tom Owens to Memphis and for me in exchange. So they told me after I got there, they said, look, if you destroyed our guards like you did, you know, in that final 2 minutes of the game, we want that kind of guard on our team. So I went with them, played 2 years with them up until the merger and everything. Mm-hmm. So that was a great 2 years down there because I met some great people, the owners of Ozzy and Danny Silna, you know, and I'm still very close with them.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's interesting on a couple levels. You mentioned being traded for Tom Owens in 1981. Tom Owens is the guy the Pacers trade a future first round draft pick for to Portland to bring in because they need a center. And that draft pick turns out it could have been used on Michael Jordan three years later. So There's Tom Owens' claim to fame for the Pacers. Uh-huh. Also, I'm told, though, that Mike Storn had promised you guys that you'd stay together.
Yeah.
And then right away he trades you.
Yeah.
That's business, right?
That's business. and really and truly, I appreciated that because I went to another atmosphere and a franchise.
A better situation.
Much better situation for me.
Roger and Mel couldn't have been too happy about it, though.
Well, if you look at that and think of that, they didn't even finish.
No.
They didn't finish the season out down there.
I know Mel got hurt and Roger got traded later, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Roger got traded back here. Yeah,
He was in Utah briefly and then came back, yeah.
Oh, did he? I don't even remember.
Yeah, briefly. Well, okay. Didn't play much, but then Slick brought him back.
Yeah, Slick brought him back.
And he tended to bring guys back, and we'll talk about that later. But so you're in St. Louis, and in 1975, the ABA's All-Star Game is in San Antonio, and you are playing in that game. Joe Namath was brought in to be the speaker at the banquet the day before the game, and yes. I read once where he was paid like $10,000. I mean, this is Joe Namath, this really 5-6 years after the Super Bowl, and he's as big a name as there is in sports, and they pay him $10,000 to come in and give a speech, and I heard he gave a lousy speech, and
yes.
nobody was too happy with it.
No.
Willie Nelson performed and sang the national anthem, and this is before Willie Nelson was well-known, but Freddie Lewis is named the most valuable player of the All-Star Game. You scored 26 points. Mm-hmm. And your reward for being MVP is a horse.
Yes.
A horse and saddle.
Uh-huh.
And, I guess they gave you a cowboy hat to put on as you accepted the horse. You got your big afro and you got a cowboy hat on there. You're
getting
the horse.
Well, see, they had an award for assists, too, and I won that because I had 10 assists in that game also. And they gave me a saddle and a hat.
Okay.
And you know, a cowboy hat. And that I gave to Mel. You know, because Mel is...
He's the cowboy.
He's the cowboy.
And you sold the horse, I understand.
I sold the horse back to him because they told me I would have to pay a fee to get it transported back to wherever I wanted it to go. And I said, well, I'd rather, you know, just sell it back, get the money, and be done with it.
I think so, I read where you got like $1,950 for it. Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
Yeah. But I also heard that you had a place in Arizona, and you had some horses?
Yes, I had some quarter horses out in Arizona. And I had really thought about taking it to Arizona. And then I said, well, how much would it cost me to transport it? I was assuming that they had given the horse all of its shots and everything, so they thought I was going to take it. And when I took it, I would, of course, you know, get all the shots and stuff for it. But when I declined to take it, they didn't give the horse its shots anymore. And that's what happened with the horse. You know?
Okay.
It's sorry to, you know, that something like that would happen, but the horse's name was Tough Julie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They kind of thought Dr. J was going to win the horse because of Julie, you know, the name Julie, Dr. J, Julius Irvin.
Well, that's funny because they're giving you this honor for winning MVP, but it's really not much of a gift because you got to give it shots and transport it.
Yes.
It's going to cost you money.
It's going to cost me money.
So thanks a lot.
Yeah, and this is the first time. Well, of course, it's in San Antonio. That's a cowboy town or whatever. But this is the first time that any organization or any league gives a horse, an animal, for most valuable player. Everybody's expecting a car.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what I was expecting. I said, well, I'm ready to drive my car back. Hey, come out with Tough Julie.
Lewis finishes his career with the Pacers, but he has an unhappy conclusion with the franchise when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One on One. I'm Mark Monteith. This week's guest is the original Pacer, Freddie Lewis. Now, don't forget, if you've missed part of this or other episodes of this series, don't despair. Just go to our website at 1070thefan.com. Scroll to the bottom of the homepage, click on the one-on-one window, and you'll have access to all the conversations with Indiana sports legends. Now back to Freddie Lewis, who was able to complete his career with the Pacers in the NBA, but didn't go out as he hoped. Well, you finished your career in the ABA. You are the, and always will be, because there's no more ABA, the sixth all-time leading scorer in the ABA, third in assists, second in minutes played behind Louis Dampier. You played all nine seasons of the ABA. Many guys, Louis Dampier did it, and maybe one or two others. Not very many guys can make that claim.
Louis Dampier and
Byron Beck. I have heard that. You played all 9 years.
Three of us, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So then the Pacers are one of the four ABA teams to go to the NBA, and Slick brings you back for a year. So you finish your career with the NBA Pacers as a backup point guard. And I remember you know, you didn't have big numbers, but I do have memories of a couple games where you had big games. I think you had 28 points in Chicago or something like that. For some reason, that sticks out in my memory. That last year, were you kind of satisfied to go out that way? I mean, to play in the NBA?
I wasn't satisfied at all because I felt like I could have had a few more years to play. And, the organization just didn't feel as though I fit in, so they let me go.
But you thought you could still play?
I know I had three more years to go.
Yeah.
And I was promised a job. You know, I have to say that. I was promised a job in order to retire with the Pacers, but that never came about because the ownerships changed. You know, that everything just fell through for me. And the new owners really didn't know anything about, you know, what it was promised to me back in those days. So, you know, I never was able to get a job. But that's also a trivia question, you know, and Bob Costas has this question as a trivia question that he uses sometimes for people when they talk about the ABA. Who was the only player that started his career in the NBA, played the entire nine years of the ABA, and then retired back in the NBA?
And that's you, huh?
That's it.
Interesting. I never thought of that. Did you make any attempts to keep playing when the Pacers let you go? Did you try to catch on anywhere else?
Well, back in that time, you know, guys weren't retiring and then coming back. You know, I really wish that I could have or would have known to do something like that. But I didn't make any attempt, you know, to come back. And I was just 33 years old.
Right. This is 1977, I think, and you're 33 years old.
Just 33 years old.
And you weren't beat up?
No, wasn't beat up, didn't no injury, you know. Nothing like that. And, you know, I have to tell you this story, too, that Boston wanted me, you know, to come there. And, you know, the Pacers waited until after the trade deadline, you know, to release me. So I wasn't able to go. My attorney called me and he asked me if the Pacers was letting me go trade deadline night. And I thought that they were, but then they decided they weren't going to let me go. So I was stuck here. And they told me that I was going to finish out the season and everything with the Pacers and help the younger guys along. And, you know, after they asked me if my attorney called me and asked me if I was ready to go the next day, I told him no, they didn't put me on waivers. He asked me if there was somebody that I knew of that Boston could pick up, because Boston wanted me to fill in for Charlie Scott, who had dislocated his shoulder against us in a game probably a week or two before the trade deadline. So they wanted to pick me up to fill his spot. And I was excited to go because I knew that I was going to be playing with Havlicek, Cowens, JoJo White. I was going to be on the side of JoJo White. So what happened was I said, well, I know a friend of mine that could come up and fill the spot for you. And so I sent a guy by the name of Bobby Wilson. I gave them, you know, his name to contact him and everything. So he went up and finished out the season. Then, you know, they let him go. But, you know, I felt like I could have filled that spot, you know, and been there for a couple of more years.
Yeah.
You know, if I would have been let go before trade deadline. And then it was, you know, it's heartbreaking to me because for them to keep me here after trade deadline and telling me I'm going to stay there for the rest of the season and help the younger guys out, and then we go on the West Coast road trip And they tell me on that, they say, well, when we go back home, you're going to have to retire or we're going to put you on waivers. I mean, that just was a dagger in my heart.
Yeah. This is kind of a too typical pro basketball story. You have a great career with the franchise. You win championships and all the individual contributions. You're the captain, and it ends like that. And you hear these stories a lot. Yeah. You must have been kind of bitter at the end for the way this finished up.
I was.
Yeah.
I was very upset and bitter because I just felt like, you know, everything that I had worked so hard for, I wanted to go out, you know, on a good level. But it was just like the rug was pulled right off from underneath my feet.
So what did you do then? 1977, you're done with basketball. What did you do?
Well, like I was saying about the Silna brothers, who owned the team in St. Louis, they had bought a hotel out in Las Vegas. And they told me, if you want a job, just come on out here with us and we'll take care of you.
Okay.
So I went with them. And as a matter of fact, I still work off and on with them right now today.
Oh, okay. What did you do at the hotel?
I was a pit boss at one time. From that, I went on to when they sold the hotel, they had a embroidering factory out in California. So I moved to California and worked as a boss in their embroidering factory.
Okay. Yeah. Let's kind of catch up. What all have you done since then? I mean, you've done a lot of different things and lived in different places.
Uh-huh. Well, I live in Washington, D.C. A couple years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I took a position in the CBA as part owner of a team up in Pittsburgh called the Pittsburgh Explosions. And the CBA has since, you know, folded because they didn't have enough teams to play. So I've, you know, just backed away from basketball in that sense. And I have a little clothing store now up in Pittsburgh that I run.
Oh, so, okay. Like a men's clothing store?
Men's clothing store.
What's the name of it?
Sporting. Freddie's Men's and Women's Apparel.
And this is in Pittsburgh?
In McKeesport.
Oh, McKeesport. Okay.
Suburb of Pittsburgh.
Okay. Okay, good. Okay, Freddie, I got a theme question that I've asked almost everybody I've interviewed. That's when you have dreams at night, when you're sleeping and dreaming, do you dream that you're playing basketball again? Ever have dreams that you're playing?
Yes. Quite a bit, too. Especially if I've been watching some games before I go to bed and I get into them. Like with Kobe and LeBron. As a matter of fact, I had one just the other night about LeBron, you know.
And so when you dreamed, do you dream that you're playing with guys like LeBron? Or?
Yes, playing with them. And like with Kobe, you know, I thought I was, you know, one of his off guards, you know.
Yeah.
Helping him do his work. Because I often thought about Michael Jordan. When Michael was playing, you know, Michael was doing some fantastic things, but I didn't think he did anything any different than Roger did, you know. And it just wasn't publicized back in those days. We didn't have the TVs where people all over the world could see, you know, a guy like this perform. But, you know, we had, you know, some great basketball back in those days.
And
I just fantasized playing with the Dr. J, you know, he and I talk often, and I told him, you know, the only thing that I regret in my career was not being able to play a whole season with him.
Yeah.
You know, I would have loved to play one season with him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he needed help from the guard position to do the things that he, you know, did well.
Yeah.
And I thought I could have been that guy to help.
But you have actual dreams that you are playing with them?
Yes.
Not daydreams, but actual dreams.
Oh, actual dreams. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Good.
And I wake up and it's like, oh, man, you know, we're not playing.
But when you dream that you're playing well.
Yes.
Yeah. Because some guys dream that they play poorly, which is interesting to me. Some guys dream that they can't find their shoes or they can't hit a shot.
Oh, you know,
even some great players have that dream. So.
No, I always dreamed that I played well.
That's good. You might as well, if you're going to dream, you might as well play well.
Exactly, the best.
One-on-One continues in a moment. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Hope you enjoyed the hour with Freddie Lewis today. You know, he seems to typify the life of a lot of professional athletes. Even if you're fortunate enough to be a member of championship teams, it's really difficult to leave the game on your own terms. Outside of Reggie Miller, very few Pacers have done that. Most wound up getting released when they thought they could still play, or had to retire early because their bodies had broken down. After talking with Lewis and thinking about it some more, I've come to the conclusion that he should have his number retired, along with Miller, Mel Daniels, Roger Brown, and George McGinnis. I'm not saying this to patronize him, but when you think about it, why shouldn't the captain of all three championship teams, the MVP of the 72 finals, a three-time All-Star with the Pacers, and the MVP of the All-Star game while playing for another team, have his number retired? Seems to me those accomplishments have earned the honor. Now remember, you can catch this and other episodes of this series on our website at 1070thefan.com. Just click on the One-on-One window at the bottom of the homepage, and you'll have access to the podcast of all the episodes of this series. And I'll be back next week with yet another one, right here on 1070 The Fan.